I just finished participating or leading a two-week retreat at Jikoji, which is a little rustic Zen center we have up on, that we don't have, but we rent up on Skyline Boulevard on Long Ridge Preserve. And it was a lovely experience. There were 18 practitioners there for 14 days of silence, practicing quite intently. Of great seriousness and courage, and I went home every day. I would come to the retreat because I live on Skyline, so I would come to the retreat around 9:30 every day, and it was always really a kind of feeling of powerhouse. There's something tremendously powerful about the stillness of a group of people sitting together meditating in silence. The silence. People often say that silence can be stronger when there's a group of people sitting together in silence than if you're in a room alone. There's some kind of power or presence that's available there. They put in tremendous effort, and it seemed very significant for the people to participate in the retreat. And I'm still very much inspired by that event and moved by the efforts everyone made. And so I gave a talk most days, and one of the threads running through some of the talks was I talked about the seven factors of awakening, which are one of the important lists. There's many lists in Buddhism. It's one of the important lists because these are understood to be the seven factors, conditions within us. They get strengthened, developed as we become freer, as we become more awakened through this kind of practice. And these are mindfulness, investigation, effort, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. So I kind of, every day I gave a talk, and I didn't give the talks in sequence because I tried to match the talk of the day to match where people were at in the practice. So I kind of jumped around depending what was needed one day. One day equanimity was needed or tranquility or different things. So at some point I covered the topic of effort. And next day someone came in to interview and he said, yesterday's talk was on effort, but you barely touched on the subject in your talk. You kind of just skimmed right by it, you know, didn't say much about it. And, you gave him a nice talk about something else, but, you know, what about the effort part? And so it was somewhat conscious that I hadn't given a lot of emphasis on effort, partly because there was a lot of effort being given on the retreats. People were really putting their hearts into the practice. And I didn't want to mess with that because if you have people suddenly kind of think, oh, I have to rev up, and you get too excited in practice or strain too much, that the practice doesn't work very well. And on the other hand, if they feel, well, you know, Gil says they need this much effort and I'm making, 10 times that, so I think I'll back off. Mm-hmm. And so suddenly I show up the next day and everyone's, kind of like down at the pond, kind of just, floating around in the pond, because they're doing less effort. So I didn't want to mess with it because things were going fine. But I also remembered that when this person told me about my shortcoming, that I had, some years ago, I gave a series of talks here in Palo Alto on the Eightfold Path, which is also a very central teaching in Buddhism. And the Eightfold Path are the kind of central elements, kind of the broader elements. The seven factors of awakening are the kind of the inner qualities, spiritual qualities that get developed. The Eightfold Path are those eight aspects of practice that a person can engage in. So there's right view, having the right understanding of what you're doing, the right intention, having the right intention for doing that, right action, right speech, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So I was going to do a whole series of talks on these eight, and the Four Noble Truths is it's part of it. There were like 12 talks I was going to give. And pretty intentionally didn't give the talk on effort. I skipped over it. So here I was busted twice, What about the effort part? And why, this very important teaching in Buddhism, right effort, I chose to not give that talk. I just kind of, conveniently skipped over it. And someone asked me about it later, but I don't know what I said in reply, but So thinking about what this man said on the retreat to me, I've been thinking, well, maybe it's time to give a talk on effort, or at least to confess my shortcoming, and to partly to kind of reflect, why is it that I didn't want to talk much about effort? What's going on there? And so I don't have a lot to say about the topic. And I haven't formulated, carefully planned talk, but I wanted this talk to be my attempt to try to explore this topic a little bit with you and maybe come out a little bit with the reason why I've been shy to talk about it. I should say that the idea of effort or engagement or being engaged in the practice, endeavoring, persistence, is something that I've really loved in my own practice. I'm not shy from making the effort. And in fact, making effort, certain kind of effort, has been part of the delight. To be really engaged in what you love doing is a delight. To have that opportunity is a really great thing. And so I've had lots of opportunities to really engage myself in the Dhamma practice and done it as wholeheartedly as I possibly could. And it just brings me joy both to have done it at the time, and it brings me joy to think that there are times when I'm really able to give everything I have to just this doing this Dharma practice. So the idea of applying effort is something I find great delight in. I think I'm reluctant to talk a lot about effort. One is maybe not a very noble idea that I have, but one is that I'm actually a little bit shy to, you might not believe this, but I'm shy to impose ideas on people what you should do. And I want to give people a wide pasture and leave people alone. Kind of the teachings are there, the practices are there, and people in their own way will step forward and practice them and be engaged in them. And I'd rather not be in the position of kind of telling people what they should do. I'm happy to explain what the practices are and what the teachings are, but then it's up to individuals to kind of take the initiative. And to talk about effort, maybe I felt a little bit shy about talking about the right effort because the implication in my mind might have been, oh, this is the effort you should make. And so the effort, both the kind of effort and the quality of effort you make, is really something that's individual. And so I wanted to leave it in that domain. Also, it is a little bit tricky, as I said earlier, about effort, because some people will strive too much and the effort gets in the way. Some people don't strive enough. And so there's complacency. There's a couple of beautiful passages in the suttas. The most famous is the one about the tuning of the lute. And there was a monk who had been a lute player before he was a monk. And he was trying to practice, and he wasn't making much progress in his meditation. And he came to the Buddha and said, what do I do? And the Buddha said, oh, remember when you were played the lute? Now, if you had to tune your strings on your lute, and if you tighten them too tight, what happens? And he said, well, you don't have beautiful music. And what happens if they're too loose? Oh, same thing. In the same way, you have to be very careful and not be tuned too tight, make too much effort, and you don't want to be too slack in the effort either, but you don't have just the right amount. There's another discourse where the Buddha says, someone comes to the Buddha and said, how did you make effort? How did you proceed in your spiritual path? And the Buddha replies, how did you cross the flood of suffering and craving and hate and fear? How did you cross over beyond it? And the Buddha said, by not striving, not pushing ahead, and not holding back, not dallying, did I make progress, did I cross the flood? And again, this balance between pushing ahead, striving, and not holding back, not dallying, not hesitating, is the balance we have to find. And what I've found over my years of practice is that I'm often swinging, like a pendulum, across the midpoint, exact midpoint of the balanced effort. And part of practice, a healthy part of practice, is to pay attention to the effort that's required and to adjust it as we go along. Oh, that's a little bit too much. That's a little bit too little. I'm being too complacent. I'm pushing too hard here. And find that balanced effort which doesn't cause any tension. At the same time, is enough effort to make a difference in our lives. And there has to be some effort. Another reason I've been reluctant to talk about effort is that I have a strong background in Zen practice and also a little bit in Theravadan practice where there's been emphasis on effortless effort. And to make effort was in Zen sometimes, even though Zen was known as being, you made a tremendous amount of self-effort in Zen. There's a technical Japanese word called jiriki. And it means self-effort, making effort yourself. And there was also kind of a feeling in Zen that you're not goal-oriented in Zen. It's just about waking up to the present moment as it is and not trying to get to some other present moment, some distant, perfect state, rather just waking up to what's actually here. And so to make effort lends itself to the idea you're making effort to attain something. It doesn't have to be that. It could be the effort to really wake up to the present. But it lends itself to, make an effort to get someplace. And so there's a reluctance to talk about effort, even though in Zen practice a lot of effort was put out. So the idea of the effortless effort, you're supposed to be effortless. Once you're enlightened, you're not supposed to make any effort. You're supposed to be in a natural state of grace and things just pour forth from you. And so people then will think, well, if that's true for an enlightened person, it must be true for me, and I should be effortless also. And let's go hang out in the pond. Just look at, And so the... So there's a kind of juxtaposition between sometimes a reluctance to talk about effort and, on the other hand, a tremendous love for effort and really making it a strong level of endeavoring, exertion. In the Pali Suttas, in the discourses of the Buddha, just like in English, there's a lot of different words used that are kind of like energy, effort, endeavor, exertion, diligence, persistence. There's a whole bunch of words. And in fact, these words, if you read something like the Dhammapada, these words are really in the forefront. There's an expectation. The Buddha wasn't shy about using these words at all. And he was, put it out there, like, this is what you have to do. He used the words like ardency, you should be ardent. Zealful effort. Exert yourself. And there's a lot of words like that. So you find the suttas, no shyness about that. I think here in the West there's been a reluctance to talk about that kind of language. Again, partly because Americans like to strive a lot. American teachers have seen that. And Asian teachers were just amazed by the neurotic level of striving among Westerners who came to Asia. And sometimes the Asian teachers would say, boy, if our Asian students practice as hard as the Americans, they'd all be enlightened. But we were practicing as hard as Americans, but we weren't getting enlightened. And they're kind of pushing and striving and trying to, gritting our teeth and making it kind of grim effort, So this, again, so let's back off. And here you find in the West, one of the strong, both in Zen and Vipassana, kind of American versions of it, a strong emphasis on the language of acceptance. It's a matter of really radical acceptance of the present moment and just being with what is. For some people, acceptance and effort and energy don't fit harmoniously together in the same mouth. They could. It doesn't have to be exclude each other. But it's a little bit, if you're trying to get people to relax and not strive so much, not feel so bad about themselves, you don't want to say, strive and make effort. Just relax, take it easy. Because that's what a lot of people need. My teacher in Burma, he didn't do this to me, but he did it to one woman who was practicing when I was there. He said to her, strive, really make an effort, and don't come back and see me for an interview until you've made progress. And it just tied her up in knots, trying to make this kind of striving effort in order to make progress for the teacher. It just, she actually had a psychic break from that. It was very sad, because he didn't understand how to work with her. And so here in the West, we have a little bit more familiarity with Western psyches, and we know we can't, crack the whip and say, strive on, and push, and this is the day for enlightenment. Stay up until, 2 o'clock in the morning, or don't go to sleep tonight, and just go for it. I'll show up at the retreat the next day and be all these people kind of feeling so sorry for themselves and feeling, I'm a personal failure. I tried and nothing happened and it's hopeless for me and I should try Sufi dancing. So that's some of the reasons, I think, about some of the reluctance to talk about it. In being reluctant to talk about it, of course, we're doing everyone a disfavor, a disservice also. It might be a great service, it might be a necessary kind of skillful means, but also it's a disservice in the sense that for some people, it's really appropriate and inspiring to hear about effort and engagement and persistence and really throwing oneself into it. And by not talking about that, they might think, oh, I'm not supposed to. That's not a possibility. So effort is required. There's no human life without effort. That's kind of built into being a human being, as we make all kinds of efforts. And so effort is not a foreign thing to being a human being. Christopher Titchener says, we shouldn't be called human beings, because we've forgotten about the being part. We should be called human busyings, because we're always so busy, you know. Or he also has the word human, or homo shoppians. Homo consumerins. But the beingness. But the effort is always part of human life. And the question is not whether we should make effort or not. The emphasis should not be whether, the question is not whether we should make effort or not. The question is, where do you want your effort to go? What do you want your effort to be about? Now, when you sit down to meditate, it's very interesting what happens. Because, especially for the uninitiated, you sit down to meditate, you close your eyes, and you try to steady the mind on the breath, or you try to do nothing. You try to just be and not make it do anything particular, or just try to be concentrated or be mindful. And pretty quickly you realize that there's a tremendous amount of energy to do everything else under the sun. That the mind is racing off to, you know, thinking about fantasies or thinking about the conversations you had and thinking about better rejoinders you could have had. And, you know, there's a lot of effort in thinking about the better answer you could have had. Or, you know, all this effort suddenly goes into cleaning the garage. You're sitting here peacefully and you say, oh, the garage, it's Sunday and, you know, I could do that instead and I've moved these boxes around and probably... And there's effort goes in that line. Or suddenly you have a sexual fantasy. And not only is there mental effort, but suddenly you feel this arising of kind of physical energy too. And suddenly you were kind of sleepy until that's... And suddenly it's all this, you know, this energy's there. Wow, heat. you remember, you know, what your coworker said to you at work recently. And it was not a very kind thing. And suddenly, you know, you were... Again, kind of, you know, not, you were kind of being kind of complacent, kind of easygoing, and you have this memory, and suddenly there's a lot of energy there to think and criticize, and, you know, it's hard to contain yourself because the energy is... So effort is often there by itself. Right effort is defined by, in Buddhism, by the understanding and the purpose for the effort that you engage in. Or it's how taking the effort that's there, the vitality, the energy of your life, and directing it in ways that are skillful and useful for your life and for the life of others. So making effort is not so much an issue of making something which didn't exist before. It's more like redirecting the effort that we already have for more skillful purposes. So making effort in a certain direction. The definition of right effort in the Eightfold Path, and the Pali word is vayama, not virya, vayama. And the right effort there is defined as cojoining your effort with particular views and purposes in mind. So it's a particular channeling it for a particular purpose. And the classic definition can be summed up in four words. It's four different practices. It's guarding, abandoning, developing, and sustaining. Something like that. So I'll explain. The first one is protecting yourself from the arising of unskillful states of mind that have not yet arisen. So guarding yourself, making the effort to protect your quality of your mind. Your heart, your mind is a really precious commodity. It's a really precious, precious thing that we have. And how do we, in this precious life that we have, that's very short, what do we do with that, our mind and our hearts? And what kind of quality do we want to maintain? It's very easy to be unguarded and then to have all kinds of inner forces and outer forces affect the quality of our mind. Buddhism says you should protect the quality of your mind. It's an important resource. So how do you protect the quality of your mind? I mean, you might want to avoid those kind of activities that cause you to have an unskillful, unhealthy states of mind. So, for example, if you know that every time you drive on 101 at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you tend to get kind of angry and irritated, it might be valuable for you to avoid 101 at 5 o'clock, take a little bit longer route that doesn't involve stop-and-go traffic if it's still backed up. That would be called a skillful thing to do. You're doing that, you're making effort to avoid the arising of something unhealthy. And so you can probably, in your own way, can kind of reflect on ways in which you probably already do this and ways you can do it more. Some people find that it's not very helpful to spend time with certain kinds of people. Certain kinds of people, after you spend time with them, you feel unskillful states of mind arise, unhealthy states of mind, certain activities, certain ways of being, all kinds of things. I find that I watch very little television, but when I do watch television, I find that for me, that it actually affects the state of my mind, and I don't feel good after I watch it for a while. And even though there's a kind of enjoyment in the short term, in the long term, it doesn't seem to, it tends to kind of produce not necessarily unhealthy states of mind, but kind of a feeling of kind of being kind of off. So the first effort is the effort to avoid the arising of unskillful states of mind which have not yet arisen. So that takes a certain amount of self-awareness to know what that is. The second right effort is to abandon those unskillful states of mind that have arisen. So you're stuck in rush hour traffic on 101, you get off the freeway, first chance you get. you get off freeway at Whipple and go out to the Baylands and sit looking at go for a walk or until the traffic dies down. Whatever it takes, But when you notice, you have to have that kind of mindfulness to notice that are unskillful, unhelpful states of mind. Now it's very important to notice here that the word kusala, translated as skillful or wholesome, unskillful, unwholesome, are very different than the language of good and bad. It isn't that you should avoid bad states of mind, but rather you avoid that which is unskillful, that which is unhelpful for you. It's a very much more friendly kind of attitude to notice what is helpful and what is unhelpful, and avoid what is unhelpful and do what's helpful. So when you notice that unhelpful states of mind have arisen, unhelpful behavior has, your unhelpful behavior, unskillful behavior, it doesn't help you or anybody else, then make the effort to abandon them. Whatever it takes. Mindfulness practice, antidote practice like loving kindness, going for a walk, taking a nap, do whatever. Leaving the situation, whatever it takes. Whatever is healthy and helpful way of approaching it. The third right effort is to cultivate or arouse skillful states, helpful states, which have not yet arisen. So you're going about your life and you notice that, that there's not much generosity. Generosity is a nice state of mind to have. So it would be nice to kind of arouse that. Let's see what I can do to develop a little bit more generosity. Maybe I can develop more generosity by just kind of being a little more considerate and reflective about the people I encounter, and kind of notice their good qualities, or notice their heartfeltness, or notice their capacity for joy and happiness. Notice something about people rather than, I don't like the color of their socks, or some kind of judgment we have. Notice something. Let's cultivate kind of appreciation of people. And then make an effort at this. And then in making effort and appreciating people, then make an effort to cultivate some generosity towards people. So that's, generosity is considered a very helpful state of mind to have. Loving kindness is considered a very helpful state to have. Love, kindness, friendliness. Compassion is helpful to have. Joy is considered a very helpful state of, to have. It's, you're encouraged in Buddhism to be joyful. And that might seem kind of like a whole topic in itself, but you're encouraged to be joyful. I've had a number of situations where people have come for interviews and retreat, and they have had backgrounds in particular kind of religious traditions where they were told it was not okay to feel joy, and it was sinful or something. And it's kind of somewhat common when you sit and meditate, especially on retreat, to have joy bubbling up. And they felt something was wrong, and they come to interview to confess. And sometimes this joy is kind of physical joy, sensual joy that rises through meditation, even worse. And I would use all my authority and my role and whatever I could as a meditation teacher and whatever projection they had on me, and I would say, it's okay to experience joy. I thought that was an okay use of my role. The okay use of the transference and everything. So to recognize what are helpful states of mind, skillful states of mind, and to see what you can do to cultivate it. The fourth right effort is the effort to sustain, maintain, nourish skillful states of mind that have already arisen. So again, it takes some mindfulness to recognize, oh, joy is there. I remember this story I've told sometimes, but it's a story about how easy it is to lose our helpful states, our healthy states of mind. I was on retreat, teaching retreat once, and there was a woman on the retreat I'd known for some time who struggled mightily, had a lot of suffering and inner conflict and outer conflict, and I'd never known her to really be happy or really be calm. And you know, she was making a really good effort and trying to be mindful, and the inner conflict was so strong. And one day we had an interview right after one of the morning sits, and I sat and she sat in the hall with everyone else. And I had a very good sitting. I was very calm, very peaceful myself. I went to the interview room. I sat in the chair. A moment later, she came in. And somehow she'd had a very good sitting too. And she was remarkably calm and peaceful and at ease. And it's one of those kind of interviews where a person comes in and you don't feel like you want to talk. You know, just like, what can you talk about? You sit there and you sit in this kind of feeling of peace and ease and everything's okay in the universe. And what would you, you know, what is there to say? And so we sat there together and kind of just enjoying this kind of, you know, both of us kind of reflecting it back to each other perhaps and being somewhat in the same state. And then she said, you know, I'm feeling, you know, really peaceful and nice right now. It's really great. And then she said, oh, but yesterday I was feeling horrible and terrible. And then she started proceeding to tell me about yesterday. And it was so sad to watch this person kind of pull herself out of the peace or pull, kind of dredge out from inside of her, her horrible conflicts and completely obliterated the peaceful state she was in. It would have been nice if she could have kept it going, you know, for a few more minutes. She didn't have to talk about yesterday, you know. But so when is it we have joy? When do we have peace? When do we have delight? When do we have love? When do we have some ease in our life? And how easy is it that we kind of lose it, that we give it up? I've seen it in myself, how easy, phenomenally easy it is. I've seen it in such simple things as coming home or meditating in the morning or doing something where I feel basically at peace and at ease with myself. And then I notice that I haven't checked email for a while. And, you know, pretty soon I'm checking email. And an email is one of those things that it's kind of like television. It doesn't lend itself, for me, to great states of mind. And in fact, it kind of, you know, you can actually, you know, I do it for a while, and oh, wait a minute, I was feeling kind of good, and now I feel a little bit, you know, however you feel. So, you know, so the idea of, you know, noticing when we have healthy states of mind, and then protecting them, or nourishing them, supporting them, appreciating them, simply appreciating them, strengthens them. Now, these four practices, right efforts, are fraught with danger. One danger is measuring yourself, identifying yourself, measuring your self-worth by the absence and presence of these states of mind. It must be a personal failure that I'm feeling angry. And Buddhists are supposed to avoid angry states and have just joyful states. And I've been given this practice and I can't do it. I just feel angry and therefore I'm a terrible Buddhist and I think I won't come this morning to Sunday morning sittings because I don't want to have to be around people where they notice that I'm being a bad Buddhist. And, you know, there's all these, or I have to have joy in order to be a good Buddhist, you know. And so it's fraught with danger of expectation and judgment, and as soon as you get involved in it and get lost in that world and comparative thinking and saying, well, I'm going to be more joyful than her, and how could she be so joyful? She should, you know, I know better, you know, I know a little bit about her background, and, you know, and this is not right. And anyway, I've known, you know, there's a lot of problems involved. But the problems shouldn't mean that we ignore these wonderful practices, these wonderful efforts, to make these kinds of efforts. So, in the Eightfold Path, that's what right effort involves. The classic definition of it is these four practices, these four efforts, making these efforts. There's a whole other class of effort, and that is the effort of putting energy, exertion, vitality into what we do. Now, it could be as simple as showing up. It's said that 90% of Buddhist practice, 99% of Buddhist practice is showing up. But that means you have to understand what showing up means. Just showing up to the moment, not just showing up for the sitting group. I mean, you could show up here, you know, Sunday morning at 9 o'clock, and then be gone for the next hour, right? You know about, you probably know that little bit. You know, you sit here, you have all this great aspiration, and you're thinking about what happened yesterday. And you realize, you know, after when the bell rings, how long you've been gone in some kind of thought. To show up can also mean to show up moment by moment to this moment. To make the effort to show up. It's actually significant to make the effort to show up at a sitting group or show up to your morning meditation. I have tremendous respect, tremendous appreciation and awe for the people who have a regular daily sitting practice and simply show up for it. Just the fact of showing, forget it, let's not even look at how good their sitting is. Just to simply make the effort to do that every day. I think it's a phenomenal thing. When people who show up at a sitting group week after week make that effort, when there's, you know, so many other things you can do in life, there's television programs that people have to miss. I think it's really impressive to me that make that the effort to show up. Then once you make the effort to show up on your cushion, then you make the effort to show up in the moment, effort to make show up in your body, to be present here. That's a really significant effort to make. And once you show up to make the effort to be here, then there's all kinds of other efforts you can make. You can notice, for example, you've shown up and you notice your mind is off thinking about judging someone. And am I really going to spend my life effort, pour my effort, the vitality of my life, into judging my neighbors? Is that really useful? I've done it now for 10 years. I'm really good at it. If I don't do it for the next 40 minutes of my sitting, I don't think, you know, much is going to get lost. You know, so let's not judge for these 40 minutes. Let's make that effort to let go of those thoughts. Let's make the effort not to fuel them, not to engage with them, not to connect with them, not to continue them. And that's a really fantastic effort to make. To notice the directions of your mind, and say, well, those kind of thoughts I don't have to be engaged in. I don't have to do. Or there's another kind of effort which simply you notice your thinking and say, I think I'll let go of that. I'll just softly let go. I don't have to think. I don't have to be engaged in these trains of thought. I know I'll think about something else in a second, but I'm going to let go. And the effort to let go is one of the really beautiful efforts human beings can make. Let go, let go, let go. Not to let go because we're indifferent to the world, but to let go so that the mind can begin experiencing its freedom. Because the mind which is obsessed, the mind which has involved compulsive thinking, is not free. The heart which has compulsive feelings is not free. And so every moment we let go, we can let go into our freedom, which is an expression of freedom. At the retreat, I talked about how it's nice to think of, nice to see that the means and the goal are reflected in each other. That the goal of Buddhist practice is to be liberated, and the means is to practice liberation, to practice freedom. If you want to become peaceful, you practice being peaceful. If you want to be a kind person, you practice being kind. If you want to be free, you practice living your freedom, you practice being free. It's very helpful to see that the goal and the means are somehow found in each other. So we're not huffing and puffing with for a means that has nothing to do with a goal that's in the future. The taste of the goal is found in a moment of practice. The flavor of freedom. So to let go has a lot to do with that. Let go, let go, let go. You don't want to. You can do it inappropriately, of course. When I was about 20, I was hitchhiking around America with a girlfriend, visiting, kind of commune hopping. And I had gotten this idea that, you know, nothing mattered, just let go, you know, just kind of, you know, it's always a kind of expression from this. Anyways, it was, nothing matters, you know, it's all fine, it's all okay, it's all cool. Everything's one. She lost her flashlight one day. And my attitude to her losing her flashlight was not, well, let's go look for it, you know. It's like, it's cool. Just let go. And she, I think, appropriately got irritated with me. We can go look for it at least. You know, there's a time for letting go and a time for let go of it after you look for it. If you don't find it, then you let go of it. But you know, that doesn't mean you don't look. The greater the effort we make, the greater the healthy effort we make, the greater the fruits of the practice we get in return. Effort becomes a strength that we carry with us. In fact, that the ability to make effort gets self-reinforced. It's kind of like if you go for a run. If you start running as a regular practice, initially when you start running, maybe you don't have much kind of real psychic effort or energy to kind of make it go for it, and your body screams in protest. But then as you continue over the weeks and the months, at some point there's kind of like this energy, strength of energy becomes available to you. It becomes almost like second nature, like the groove begins happening. Effort is something, energy and effort is something that can be aroused and developed, so it becomes almost second nature, rather than something that you have to kind of strain to cause to arise. And it's really beautiful to have this kind of strength. The Buddha likened this kind of strength of effort or energy is to have an old dilapidated house which is about to fall down. And to have a strength of energy available to you is like bringing in a really strong pillar to prop up the house. It supports, you know, this you know, our life. So what do we do with this effort, this energy, this life force that we have in our life? How do we? Something will be done. It'll go some direction, no matter what. It'll go somewhere. Who's going to choose where it goes? Are you going to be? Is going to be taken hostage, hijacked, by your greed or your hate or by consumerism or consumer culture, or are you going to actually take some responsibility, some choice about where your life, what your life force is about? And this is the encouragement of the Buddha, is that you actually takes charge, in a certain sense, of this very precious thing you've been given, which is your life force, your life vitality, which everyone who's alive has. It's not a matter of this, you have to doing something new to make it happen. But as you apply it in the right direction, it becomes a strength that you begin carrying with you. The last thing I'll say is that in the discourses of the Buddha, they describe one of the approximate causes for the arising of right effort and energy. And the approximate cause is a sense of urgency. It's sometimes translated as sense of urgency. I call it a passion for practice, but maybe it doesn't really, it's not a very accurate translation, a little biased perhaps. But the word is samvega. And it's the kind of feeling you have that if you have like a brush with death, or if you encounter someone, you know, you've been around someone who just died, it was really important for you, or you're in a national crisis, the kind of suddenly arousing, oh, this life is really precious, this is really important, I have to take things seriously, I have to be alert here, I have to, you know, I don't want to be complacent, I don't want to just go back to business as usual and continue in watching whatever you're watching on television, you know. I mean, it's a kind of rousing, kind of arousing of kind of emotion and feeling and energy that can be, if it's not fraught with fear, but can be if it's without fear or aversion, can be very, very helpful and healthy. And that emotion, that arousing of energy, a sense of urgency or sense of preciousness or sense of now is important, is called samvega in Buddhism. And to cultivate that samvega is one way to arouse healthy energy. Just as when you know you have this energy when you have sexual fantasy arise, so there can be healthy energy when you realize how precious this life is. And so, oh, you know, I too am going to die. What am I going to do with this little life that's left? It's really precious. So effort, I think, is one of the most precious things we have going. Our ability to make effort, the energy, the vitality, our ability to be persistent over time. Right effort, the effort to practice always bears fruit. No moment of practice is ever wasted. And the more you commit yourself to showing up, the greater the fruits will be in your life. And so it's your choice about where you put your effort. It's your choice how many moments a day you decide to commit to showing up. But I'd hope that you want to show up all the time. If you don't show up to what's real, you miss it. You know, what's the alternative? So may you all make your best effort to show up and learn in doing that to find that midpoint, that balance point that you'll swing back and forth over and over again, where you're neither striving in a tense way or being complacent and holding yourself back. And you find the appropriate way to find your way. Thank you.